Hello everyone and welcome to JFG tonight. This is a post-debate stream. My brain is hurting. I mean, we've been exposed to so much fallacious thinking, so much attempt at grasping straws. I mean, it was kind of pathetic. Lendalt Guntram says Nadir got hammered. Yeah, I mean, it's painful just how much twist he's willing to do to really hold to the idea that these words are holy. These words are not even insightful by the standard of their own time. So this is the whole idea of Nadir, and if you want to watch the debate, you can. The link is in the description, but I'd rather warn you, it's like painful. You're going to be thirsty for the parts where I speak, and then you're going to be bombarded by fallacious reasoning. The whole idea of Nadir is to take a couple of loosely stated things in the Quran and say, oh my god, this had so much insight for the time, and it was pre-scientific, and it was knowing about the truth of the world before science discovered it. But he makes very weak points along the way, and we had a long discussion before the show began because we exchanged emails for the last 24 hours. And he told me all of my arguments will be from this debate. And so I had the privilege of watching all of his arguments, and I wanted it to be fair. So in exchange, I said, okay, since he's informing me of this, I will send my own counter arguments in advance. So we both knew what we were going to talk about, and he tried twisting himself out of some of the stuff he was going to talk about. For example, the warrior prophet aspect, I will cover it now, but he chose not to cover it. Gender determination, it used to be an important part of his argument, but I think he saw my counter argument to it in the pre-show emails, and he decided to keep it just for the end. And then he had a whole argument about the Quran knows about the frontal lobe of the brain being involved in decision making, because it says at some point the forelock of a liar, the forelock being the front head or maybe the front hairs of the head. And he says this is but he didn't say it in the debate, because I think he abandoned these points when he saw my counters. But he originally wanted to make the argument that the forelock statement in the Quran shows that the Quran knew about lying and decision making emerging in the frontal lobe. Of course, my response to this, because the whole idea of saying a forelock is lying, that's like saying stupid face. It's like we're saying you look like a stupid face, or you, what's his face? You know, this expression where we attribute some cognition to the face itself. This looks much more like this, the statement in the Quran. And I also pointed out to him in the pre-show conversation another quote from the Quran that says the criminals will be known by their marks, and they will be seized by the forelocks and the feet. So if forelock means frontal lobe in ancient Arab, which it doesn't, but if you want to adapt his crazy interpretation, then why would the criminals be grabbed by the forelocks? They would be grabbed by their brain, literally. It's like, let me take you, criminal, and drag you around by your brain. Doesn't make sense. If they were dragged around by the forelock, then it means forelock, as written in the Quran, means the front hair, or at best maybe the forehead, but it certainly doesn't mean the frontal lobe. And yet he wanted to make that argument. He gave it up because I announced my counter in advance to him, so perhaps wise of him, but at the same time I had undermined in the pre-show all of his arguments. So perhaps I can Zedez says, why don't I have the 144p option? Sometimes you have to refresh the window, and generally it doesn't show at the beginning. If you've been on the show for too long, it won't show it. You have to be refreshing the window like after a minute that the show has been going on. For some reason, that's how it's done. Join me on Entropy. It is my favorite platform for super chats. It is the right place to support the show. Or you can use the support button on Odyssey. They have an amazing USD option for super chats. Did you watch the debate? And was it a good performance for JF? That is the survey question tonight on Entropy. And you can answer it by following the Entropy link right below the video. So, I think we can get through some of the arguments, because in the format that the debate took with time limits on both sides is ridiculous. Because time limits is good if you have a big fight and people don't respect the speaking turns, but time limits suck when you have someone like me who's, anyway, I will respect my opponent, I will let him finish his points. Then time limits become an hindrance. But he insisted at the beginning of the debate to get the time limits, so I said, all right, let's get the time limits. 2 minutes. So, in a way, the time limits were working on my side, because he's the one who was loose-brained and who was totally, you know, spreading multiple ideas at the same time. I was just answering each of his points one by one. So, a point he had made in his original debate, but he didn't make tonight, was that there is a link between Moses and Mohammed. So, the prophet of ancient Judaism and the prophet of Islam. And I said in my counter, so I guess that counter was too effective for him, which is why he didn't raise it tonight. I said, there is definitely a resemblance between ancient Judaism and Islam in that they are two religions that have strict food prohibition and have been led by warriors. But this does not indicate prophecy. It merely indicates that history repeats itself. So his original point was, how could Moses have predicted that Muhammad would rise? Well, all that Moses would have said is, there will be some warrior that will take over the area, and that's not super hard to guess when you've been through war and when you've been through through tough times, that there will be similar tough times in the future. Me Too says 128 watching now, but there was 252 a few minutes back, so maybe the system doubles the numbers as an error that affects reception at our end. Yeah, the 252 was a weird number. I think it was just a reflection of a programming error. I'm pretty sure that 133 is a more realistic number, because I don't tend to attract as much when I don't have a news item on the thumbnail. 130 is more of a realistic number for my show, whereas 252, we see that kind of numbers, but when I talk about the news or when I have a big guest. So then he had a whole thing about alcohol, and he thinks that modern science has established that alcohol is bad. And modern science didn't really establish this. You may have scientists who think this, you may have scientists who think differently. But the idea that something is bad is not establishable by science, because there are pros and cons to most things. And really, it's a moral decision whether you prefer to have the pros of one thing or the cons of this thing, and the pros of another thing or the cons of another thing. So the idea that science could prove that alcohol is bad is ridiculous. Science can prove that alcohol causes this and that and this and that. And then you make a choice about whether that is good or bad for you. That was not a main point, and it didn't matter. But I wanted to correct him on his kind of assumption that, oh, there is scientific agreement. There's never been a conference where people gather to establish the scientific consensus on alcohol. It's a bunch of beliefs, and people can have them or not. But most importantly, he was claiming that somehow the Quran has gotten the alcohol science right from the beginning. And to that, I knew I had a different quote of the Quran that explained why this prohibition on alcohol. And I knew that it doesn't have anything to do with science. So it's not like the Quran had previous knowledge that there would be consequences for babies if pregnant women were to drink alcohol, which is what he brags about. But it's not like this. I knew that there was this quote in the Quran that says, "Indeed, Satan desires to incur enmity and hatred between you through wine and gambling. And he desires to prevent you from God's remembrance and prayer." So what they were saying clearly is that the reason you shouldn't take alcohol is that alcohol comes from Satan, and it's a way to create social enmity. So they knew that alcohol was leading to bad social behavior. And that gives the explanation of why they were banning alcohol. Not that they knew about any of the health effects long term or the science of the effects on the embryo. So when a text indicates why they do something, you can trust the text. The text is telling you why it mattered, and it's not a scientific explanation. Or you can call it a form of proto-social science. They knew that there were some social effects to alcohol, but that is not the evidence for a divinity. It's just evidence that people back then understood, I have drunk friends and they don't sound very good when they're drunk. The back door says he wouldn't answer a single question. At some point he should have been made to fuck or walk, like answer the question or capitulation. Yeah, but on these neutral debate platforms, you're never gonna have the moderator call out the fallacies like this and the evasion. That's the difference where if I'm hosting a debate, I intervene as an intellectual and I say, whoa, that's not fair, that's not true. But of course, these platforms, they want to remain neutral. And that's to attract future guests. They don't want guests to be afraid that they will get destroyed 2-on-1. Then the second point that he had done in the original debate, and he has done it again tonight, is this quote from the Quran that says, "And it is he who has released the two seas, one fresh and sweet and one salty and bitter, and he placed between them a barrier and prohibiting partition." And that would be prescient knowledge of the concept of a picnic line, the concept of a separation between the gradients of water, where some are more salty than other, and therefore they float above each other, and there's kind of a boundary between the two, which really isn't a boundary, it's a gradient. So first, the language is very loose. I mean, he couldn't even agree about this reading that I did, which is one of the translations. But any of the translations of the Quran you take, they all mention that somehow the two seas that they're talking about are separated. And my points on this was, one, there's no separation. In these gradients that the picnic line is, you can see some animals swimming around the boundary of the picnic line. They can freely swim. They can pass from one side to another. They can use the picnic line as a source of energy. They can be at the interface and mix in. And more importantly, there's no membrane there, although it could be membrane-like. There's no membrane. The water can pass, the molecules can pass. They just pass at a certain equilibrium. So there's as much molecules going in one direction than the other. But they're mixing, and there's no partition, there's no barrier, there's no keeping the two seas from mixing. They do mix. And that's why, for example, in certain seas like Caspian Sea, the more you have water coming in from the rivers, the least salty they are. That's because ultimately the river have a diluting effect. Lapitop says, never heard of that word before. Pycnocline. Pycnocline, P-Y-C-N-O-C-L-I-N-E. It's a concept in water ecology. Not super important scientifically, but it exists. And so we have to believe that because some kind of barrier was mentioned in the Quran, that they knew about the Pycnocline and that this was a divine intervention. The problem being, I found evidence that we knew about the Pycnocline back in 79 AD by Pliny the Elder. So this segment by Pliny the Elder states basically a better representation of what the Pycnocline is. It says, of all wonders this passeth, that certain fresh waters hard by the sea issue and spring forth as out of pipes, for the nature of the waters also sees it not from strange and miraculous properties. Fresh waters run aloft the sea, as being no doubt the lighter, and therefore the sea water, which naturally is heavier, upholdeth and beareth up whatsoever it is brought in. That's a description of the Pycnocline. The fresh water are floating above the seawater. That is exactly what you have. And he even says, yeah, and among fresh waters, some there be that float and glide over others. So you have an understanding of the interface between the two types of water, between the what in the Quran is referred to as the two types of seas. And there's nothing surprising that one would have been aware of this in 600 AD, because we were aware of this in 79 AD, and on top of it, it's visually observable. You can see the distinction between two seas where they meet. You will see the sea of one color, the sea of the other color, or the river color and the sea color. And it looks like a boundary, it looks like a barrier. So even an uninformed, unscientific observer would conclude that there is some kind of barrier, that there is some kind of partition. It's not divine inspiration, it's just observation. And then he claims that there were three truths of marine biology and marine sciences that couldn't have been known other than through revelation by a divinity. So that would be the statement in the Quran that there is no light at the bottom of the sea. It goes like this, or they are like darknesses within an unfathomable sea, which is covered by waves, upon which are waves, over which are clouds. Darknesses, some of them upon others. When one puts out his hand therein, he can hardly see it. And he to whom Allah has not granted light, for him there is no light. So was it common knowledge at the time of the Quran that there is less light as you dive deeper into the ocean? The answer is yes. There are reports from fishermen, from people who have interviewed fishermen. There's even Pliny the Elder again, who says words about this. He says before 79 AD, because when the sweet and thin substance thereof is sucked out from it, which the fiery power of the sun most easily dryeth up, all the tartar and more gross parts thereof remained behind, and hereupon it is that the deep water toward the bottom is sweeter and less brackish than that above in the top. He's describing his theory here of how the sun, because it hits the top of the water, must be boiling out water. It must be evaporating more water than at the bottom, which he believes is an explanation for why the sea is salty. So whether that's the explanation doesn't matter really, but it's he thinks that the sea gets higher concentration of salt because of evaporation by the sun, and he knows that the sun hits stronger at the top of the sea than at the bottom. Parthian stations in 1st century BC, even older, they state, and when the oyster lives at the bottom, it produces the clearest and largest pearls, but those that float on the surface, because they are not affected by the rays of sun, produce smaller pearls of poorer color. Another statement that indicates that the fishermen who were hunting for pearls, they knew that the pearls at the bottom will be better because they are from oyster that haven't been affected by the sun. So they knew that the rays of the sun didn't get deep into the water. And that's from Isidore of Charax, 1st century BC. And then another poet who documented this between 100 and 280, Greco-Roman poet Oppian in the Haliotica, he states, "But when he takes heart of courage, he leaps into the eddying waves, and as he springs, the force of the heavy gray lead drags him down." So that's a diver. He's carrying a weight of lead to dive quicker. The weight drags him down. "Now, when he arrives at the bottom, he spits out the oil, and it shines brightly, and the gleam mingles with the water, even as a beacon showing its eyes in the darkness of the night." So back then, the divers had a technique to see at the bottom of the ocean. They were carrying oil in their mouth, and they were spitting it out, and I don't know what the oil was doing. Was it reflecting light in a different way, or was it catching fire? I don't know. Or was it just that it was kind of lubricating their eye and providing a protection so they could open their eyes? But in any case, they describe this oil as shining in the darkness of the night. So they were developing techniques to address the fact that light doesn't get deep in the ocean. Amazing Meerkat sends a super chat on entropy. Thank you so much. He says, "Mr. Gariepi, how science explains human reaction to the works of art? How do we get a pleasure from listening to music, looking at paintings, etc.? And why plebs like simple pleasures? Is it IQ?" Well, I guess that there are many explanations for art, but art is a means of communication, so people like communication because we evolved to enjoy communication as a way of learning, as a way of identifying the quality of our partners, as a way of detecting who would be a potentially good sexual partner by evaluating their intelligence. So people like to judge, people like to evaluate and understand meanings in things because it was valuable on the sexual market to do so. That's also why comedy is valuable and interesting. So is it why the plebs like simple pleasures? Is it IQ? It could be. It could be an explanation for why someone would have a limit in terms of their interest. If you're not able to process stimuli of a certain complexity, you may not be interested in these stimuli because you cannot perceive their value. You cannot benefit from it. So yes, possible. So going back to the debate tonight, there was also the point, there's a statement in the Quran which I just read before the Dark Sea part, which says, "Waves upon which are waves, over which are clouds." Now, he says this is early scientific, this is pre-scientific understanding that there were internal waves. And it's like internal waves are just the idea that there are waves within waves. But when a poet or when in a poetic text you read waves upon which are waves, I mean, the guy could be describing waves that he sees on the horizon. He could be describing waves curling up on other waves. He could be describing waves colliding with other waves. So it's really not good evidence that, oh, a god must have written this. It's really just evidence that there was some understanding at the time that there are a series of waves in some dimension, although it's not clear from the Quran which one it is. And then on the gender determination, he kind of stepped back because it used to be one of his big cases, but he barely mentioned it, and it was at the very end. And he said, "Oh yeah, JF has good points on this." So that means he was impressed by my counter, and he decided not to make it a pillar of his argument anymore. The statement from the Quran is, "He has created both sexes, male and female, from a drop of semen which has been ejected." So that's one of the translations. It can be translated differently, but what I was explaining to Nadir is this doesn't show that they understand that the sperm determines whether you'll become a male or a female. What that shows is it was understood at the time that sperm leads to males and females. And this was not only understood in the time of the Quran, it was understood 3,000 years before. So I have this quote from an Egyptian myth. The first part of the quote is the website describing the myth, and then there's the myth itself. So they say on dailyhistory.org, "Theologically speaking, the Heliopolitan myth was the most straightforward and concrete of the cosmogonies, as it involved the atom emerging from a primordial mound and then creating the first four generations of male-female pairs, which became known as the Ennead. Creation in this myth, therefore, was the result of pure will and is a process with a definite beginning and end. How Atum created the Ennead is described in numerous utterances of the pyramid text as both physical and sexual." So there goes the pyramid text. "Atum is he who once came into being, who masturbated in on." I don't know what that means, masturbated in on. Was this a place or was he masturbating inside a female? I don't know. But the text says he took his phallus in his grasp that he might create orgasm by means of it, and so were born the twins Shu and Tefenet, which are a girl and a boy. May they put the king between them and set the king among the gods in front of the field of offerings." So it's very clear from this that people understood that the sperm leads to beings. They lead to beings that can be male and female. But that doesn't mean that when you understand this, you understand that sex determ that sperm determines the sex. And on top of it, the Quran mentions that the moment that there was the creation of man and woman was at the moment of the ejection, the moment of the ejaculation. But that is not scientifically correct if you interpret this statement as a statement of sex determination, because sex determination happens when the egg gets fertilized by one sperm or another. So that happens inside the woman, at the moment of fertilization. So the moment of ejaculation is not determining which sex the baby will be. So what I had said to him before the show was, it is only through a modern reinterpretation of the text that it appears to make a statement about sex determination by sperm. The Quran indicates that sperm was necessary to the creation of men and women. It doesn't indicate an understanding that the specific sperm cell that fertilizes the egg will carry a code for creating a male or a female. In fact, the text shows no understanding that there is such a thing as the egg. Thus, the text simply illustrates that it was understood back in those days that sperm is a necessary agent in the production of human babies, but not in the determination of sex. This is understandable because sperm was the only visible substance in the reproductive act, given the complications of observing a human egg. In fact, it is not accurate that the moment the sperm is ejected constitutes the moment of determination of the sex, as indeed any drop of sperm contains half of its sperm cells capable of producing a male and half of its sperm cells capable of producing a female. Thus, the moment of sex determination is fertilization, not ejaculation. So people are reporting buffering, I'm sorry. Hopefully one day Odyssey will improve, but for now I'm getting perfect connection, so it seems that it's on the side of Odyssey trying to distribute the material to you guys, so too bad. I'm doing what I can. If it's unbearable, you're gonna have to come back and watch the show offline. Then he had a whole idea about ants talking, and again I showed that in 79 AD Pliny the Elder describes ants communicating, exchanging information, intercourse, and communication there is between them whilst they are inquisitive as they meet one another, what news abroad, even like merchants at a bourse. So it's kind of poetic ancient English, but he's basically saying that the ants talk to each other. Finally, there was a mustard seed point, which was kind of ridiculous. It's like, in the Bible, it says that the mustard seed is the smallest of seed, but when you plant it, it is one of the greatest plants. And when you plant other big seeds, they result sometimes in small plants. And the whole idea is to say there is no relationship between the size of a seed and the size of its plant. And the Bible never said it's the smallest of all seeds that ever existed on earth. It said it's the smallest of all seeds that you plant. So they were really talking about a bunch of farmers that regularly use seeds, and they were saying among the seeds that we do plant, the mustard seed is the smallest. Well, who are you to judge this? You don't know if the farmers back in the Bible days were having seeds that were smaller than the mustard seed. So he goes on to say, well, the Quran corrected this scientific error because we didn't say that the mustard seed was the smallest. So, there's a difference between correcting an error, correcting a scientific error, and just not stating that error. Not stating an error is easy. And the discussion devolved in the debate around, you know, I can make a statement that is not erroneous by his standard, and I said, supernatural purple ponies are everywhere. That is not a statement that enters in contradiction with any scientific statements by his standard, because he told me at some point in the debate, he told me, supernatural stuff, JF, you cannot ask. You cannot ask any scientific question about it. It's totally outside of the scope of science. So I was like, okay, so basically anything that you say that's supernatural will be, by definition, compatible with science. So I said there are supernatural ponies everywhere. And that's just to show how easy it is to not be wrong. His whole shtick is to be excited that the Quran isn't wrong. But he doesn't ask himself, how much insight do I have in these 4 or 5 sentences that he's fascinated about in the Quran? So I think that one of the biggest punch I've given then was to my supernatural pony example. He said, well, JF, you haven't brought scientific evidence for your supernatural purple ponies. And I said, oh, I just caught a contradiction here, because earlier He was telling me, Jeff, you cannot ask for scientific evidence about Satan because Satan is supernatural. But there he was 4 minutes later telling me, I want scientific evidence about your supernatural purple pony. And I said, Nadir, you are violating your own principles here. You're asking for scientific evidence for a thing of the supernatural when you denied me the very thing 4 minutes ago. And I said, that looks like taqiyya. That looks like the philosophy through which Muslims based on the Quran, believe that they are entitled to lie to people who are unbelievers, who are infidels. And the way you are playing double standard with your own principle here, looks like you're treating me like an infidel in accordance with the taqiyya. So that was a little pun, and I said, I think that's very dishonest of you. That was the biggest punch I've given on that debate. Overall, I'm satisfied with my arguments, but there's not much you can do with someone who's that interested in reaching a preset conclusion, and he's not going to process the fact that, hey, there were people saying even more insightful sentences than this 500 years before your prophet. How are you going to explain? It just doesn't pass through their head. And he started baffling. I think I shook him down because he started being a little lost at the end. And at some point I said to the moderator, give him as much time as he wants. I want to get through the spinning that he's doing right here. but yeah, that was it. And that was all. I was relatively silent during the questioning session because I knew that he had been spinning for a while, that he was tired, and I didn't have much to add. The thing is, the thing you think is magical about your Quran pre-existed the Quran. It's as simple as this. Yeah, the back door says, another 2 minutes of that. Because he insisted so much on these minutes, and it's like, hey, this guy is saying so much stupid stuff. I would like him to keep going. So I told the moderator, I'm giving up my 2 minutes. Two more minutes. I want to hear more of that. He was spinning and he was getting nervous. Yeah, so, yeah. If you want to give a magical or divine interpretation to a specific piece of text, make sure it doesn't exist before that. Make sure Papa JF cannot find an older statement where that shows that basically this is all common knowledge, and it was things either that were known or that were believed back in the days. The only exception to that rule being the determination of sex, which wasn't known back in those days, but where the interpretation of the Quran that he does makes no sense. How could you know that the sperm is the determinant of sex selection, of sex determination, if you don't know that the egg exists? You can't. You have to understand that the egg exists, and then you're like, oh, is it the egg or is it the sperm that determines, that carries the sexual chromosome? But the question cannot emerge in your head if you don't understand that the egg exists and that the sperm is headed toward the egg. So that is it for my review of the debate. I guess we can look at some minimal amounts of news, but I'm not going to do a war update. I'll keep that for another day. Tomorrow at noon, we have the show, so there won't be a show at night tomorrow. At noon Eastern time, I will be speaking with Edward Dutton, so don't miss it. But people have been sending me news items. 15 out of 23 monkeys implanted with Elon Musk Neuralink brain chips have reportedly died. Well, not surprised. this installation of a chip will lead to infection. It will be hard to manage. It's certainly not something that you'll want to do on humans very soon. Samara, on an everyday basis, I understand that there will be paraplegics who it's their only hope, so you're gonna try, but you're most likely headed to your death if you are taking this chip. Samurai says, "Hi Jeff, I watched the debate. It was pretty interesting. I'm new to your channel, but I'm not white. Am I allowed to be here?" Yes, you can stay there. Stay in the regular chat. And yes, you are welcome here. I'm going to accept. For this time, I'm going to accept. Evolutionary transition from a single RNA replicator to a multiple replicator network. Someone sent me this. It's kind of a sexy title, but when you look at what they've done, they've just shown that, okay, we can conceive of an organism that would be RNA based, and it would, instead of just being one big genome, it would separate in small genomes. A small chromosome of RNA here, a small chromosome of RNA here, and they would basically collaborate. But the thing is, this is not particularly surprising. This is what happened with DNA. Chromosomes are this. They are sets of collaborating entities that are invested in the same evolutionary success of the same individual. So, I mean, when you look at the title, you think they might be talking about the revolutionary phenotype, but no, they're not talking at all about the transition from RNA to DNA. It's just, okay, you can have an RNA piece that collaborates with other RNA pieces. That's kind of laboratory circus type of experiment. Man, science sucks. Science sucks when you have that much knowledge from theory. Lab science and empirical studies, they suck ass. When you've seen the power of just your thought, that to understand the beginnings of life, and you see what these people are doing, you realize I'm ahead. I'm miles ahead of these people because I understand how you get from their result to DNA tango and then DNA self-replication. Russia's military held a big briefing this afternoon announcing the war was entering a second phase. A second phase. So basically, Russia has announced what they've been announcing from the beginning. They've been saying this all along. We don't want to invade Kiev. We don't want to invade Ukraine. We're here for saving the Donbass. They've been saying this every week since the beginning of this war. And, I didn't know if it was true. I would have said, I was saying, maybe they're bluffing. Maybe they want to invade Ukraine, or maybe they don't. But now the leftists are like, oh my God, they are really saying that they don't want to invade Ukraine. They just want the Donbass. And it's like, yeah, it's what they've been doing from the beginning. It's what they've been saying from the beginning. So why do you start believing them right now? Well, I don't know. Maybe it's the specific words used by the Russians have finally convinced the Ukrainians that this is what they want to do. They said we're entering phase two. Basically, they said we demilitarized the Ukraine, we made them weak. Now we're going to concentrate on taking the Donbass and protecting the Donbass. So the siege of Kiev was basically a place of leverage, according to this stated strategy. Now it could change and it could be a bluff, but something tells me that they're not bluffing and that this is what they want to do. So they've decided we're just going to concentrate on Donbass. Does this mean there won't be forces elsewhere? No. I think they will keep forces on the southern flank and they might keep forces fortified around Kiev. but there will not be this hanging belief that they want to eventually invade the roads of Kiev. Makes sense. And finally, as a last news item, oh my God. Mackenzie Scott makes the largest single donation in Planned Parenthood history. So she marries Jeff Bezos. She drains half of Jeff Bezos' wealth. And she's giving $275 million, which is the biggest gift ever, to Planned Parenthood to kill babies. This is the result of liberal marriage laws. It is almost infinite amounts of human killing and suffering. Almost infinite. At $275 million, you're guaranteeing the future of Planned Parenthood for forever. And this is what happens when you give billions and billions of dollars to a woman for to reward her for divorcing. New Nation sends a question on entropy. It says, Jeff, will you press Dutton on his misuse of the term dysgenic and not permit him to wriggle out of avoiding his ridiculous conception of that concept? Yeah, I mean, I'll try to do my best. It's definitely in my intentions to bring up the subject and to push, I mean, respectfully, but yes, to push to the extreme, to the highest intellectual standard. This is always what I do. So yes, I'll do it. So tomorrow at Dutton at noon, I'm cutting the show short because I'm tired. I've been through a 2-hour debate and it was cognitively, it was like a hammer on the head at every instant. But I still enjoyed doing it and much love to all of you. I'll see you tomorrow in at noon. Bye bye. Thank you.